This episode of Horsepower Heritage is sponsored by Model Citizen Diecast. Maybe you can't afford that Shelby 289 Cobra or that Porsche 356 Speedster, but having a scale model on the shelf is easy with Model Citizen Diecast. They stock collector-grade scale models in 1/43 scale, 1/18 scale, and even the massive 1/8 scale masterpieces from the Amalgam Collection. And if you use the promo code HERITAGE at checkout, they'll give you 10% off your order. Limitations apply. Just visit modelcitizendiecast.com and check out their great selection. From race cars to classic cars and everything in between, Model Citizen Diecast, because your inner child still wants to play with cars. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Horsepower Heritage. I'm Maurice Merrick, and greetings to all of you listening from places like Flemington, New Jersey, Mount Prospect, Illinois, Bandera, Texas, Colombo, Sri Lanka, Katowice, Poland, and Bern, Switzerland. Thanks for joining me once again, and I have to tell you, things have been super hectic lately. I just got back from a trip to Italy, nearly 2 weeks over there, and it was fantastic. Not a lot of car stuff. I saw the occasional classic Fiat or Renault 4, and a few late model Ferraris caught my eye, but mainly it was museums and antiquity. So it was a terrific trip, but let me tell you, re-entry is never easy after a vacation like that. And I've been pretty much nonstop since getting home. I'm trying to get a car ready for an event that's coming up, and the Mullen Automotive Museum's auction is just a few days away. All this to say, I haven't had much time for the podcast in the last week and a half, but I can't leave you hanging. So here's one from the vault. And it's one of my favorite episodes, Gulf Racing, The Glory Years. And when you think of those famous colors, tangerine orange and zenith blue, it conjures up a whole lot of images in your mind, right? GT40s, Porsche 917s. Anyway, the backstory is terrific. So if you haven't heard this one, I think you're going to enjoy it. And if you have heard it before, it's a good one to revisit. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. But for now, enjoy this encore presentation of Gulf Racing, The Glory Years. Like I said, we all know those distinctive colors, right? Well, the key figure behind those glory years was an Englishman named John Wire. His career in auto racing began in 1950, when at the age of 40, he was hired by David Brown to manage Aston Martin's factory racing program. And that culminated in their first win at Le Mans in 1959, with Carroll Shelby and Roy Salvadori behind the wheel of a DBR1. Fast forward to 1963. Ford Motor Company tried to buy Ferrari, but they got rebuffed by Enzo Ferrari himself. So they went looking for a car builder in England to help achieve Henry Ford II's ambition of beating Ferrari at Le Mans. The logical choice was a guy named Eric Broadley, the founder of Lola Cars. He'd just completed the Mark VI, a mid-engine lightweight GT car powered by the Ford 260 V8 small block in front of a Colotti transaxle, which was Italian-made. And incidentally, it was originally commissioned by Colin Chapman from Lotus. Now, simultaneously, John Wire was lured away from Aston Martin, and Ford established a subsidiary called Ford Advanced Vehicles, which was co-located with Lola in Slough, just west of London. And it was there that Wire became part of the team that developed the Lola Mark VI architecture into the Ford GT, which was soon to be called the GT40, a reference to it being just 40 inches tall, the minimum allowed by FIA rules. Power came from the 289 V8, but the transaxle remained the same Colotti unit. In the spring of 1964, the GT40 had its maiden race at the Nürburgring, but as the season progressed, there were mechanical problems, and they didn't finish a single race. And the cars were also lifting at speed. With the program failing to yield the immediate victories Ford expected, they reorganized the whole thing and created a Le Mans committee to coordinate multiple development projects. Holman and Moody of Charlotte, North Carolina, was brought on board. They'd been preparing Fords in NASCAR since 1957, and now their job was to shoehorn the 427 big block V8 into the GT40 chassis.
A company called Carcraft in Dearborn was also hired, and they were supposed to design and build a sturdier transaxle to replace the Kalotta unit, which again was designed for use with a small block Ford but wasn't going to hold up, bolted to the 427. At the same time, Carroll Shelby essentially replaced John Wire in managing the racing program, and the cars were shipped to Los Angeles. The new arrangement with Wire was for him to assume responsibility of building all the road-going GT40s and providing parts and service. So a new partnership was established with his friend John Wilmint, a successful Ford dealer whose own race team had been tearing it up in Cortinas and the big Ford Galaxy. They called the new company JW Automotive Engineering. Now, Wire's ouster from the racing program wasn't a reflection of his ability in any way, because whereas his approach had been very analytical and deliberate with meticulous analysis to achieve incremental changes, Carroll Shelby always got right down to brass tacks. Make it faster. Make it handle better. He'd give his team the bottom line, and they would work furiously through relentless testing and trial and error. It was a bit like spinning plates in the air, but it paid off with victories at Sebring and Daytona in 1966. And then it came time for the big daddy, Le Mans. Ford's strategy was to support parallel racing teams, which was not uncommon. Ferrari did it all the time. And 14 GT40s were entered. One car crashed during practice and 10 retired during the race. And the remaining three finished 1, 2, and 3, with Ford staging a photo finish. 29-year-old Bruce McLaren was behind the wheel of the winning car, and Ken Miles grudgingly took second place, which is a story unto itself, and of course, if you've seen Ford versus Ferrari, you know what I'm talking about. But back to John Wire. Ford had already reconsidered its presence in endurance racing. Having beaten Ferrari, they soon pulled factory involvement and the advanced vehicle operation was no more. However, at the Slough factory, Wire was still leading the construction of GT40s. One day, the phone rang, and on the other end of the transatlantic call was a voice inquiring about purchasing a car. The Texas drawl belonged to Grady Davis, the executive vice president of Gulf Oil Corporation. Davis had raced Corvettes in the SCCA, and with the backing of Chevrolet, he worked with Zora Arkus Duntov and Pennsylvania Chevy dealer Don Yanko to make the Corvette a serious platform, even winning national championships until Chevy pulled out of factory sponsorship in 1963. But quickly, the two men became friends, and Davis threw the support of Gulf Oil behind John Wire and the GT40. Their first effort was modifying a GT40 by narrowing the cockpit for smoother airflow. They called this car the Mirage M1. Three were built, and they were the first machines to wear the now legendary Zenith Blue and Tangerine Gulf livery. Gulf's corporate colors were actually navy blue and orange, but Davis had run those colors on his own GT40, and it just wasn't distinctive enough. There were plenty of other cars running dark blue paint schemes. At any rate, he specified the powder blue instead, which turned out to be a brilliant move, and he probably didn't know anything about equal luminance or color theory. The Mirage won at Spa in Belgium in 1967. Later, one of the cars was wrecked at the Nürburgring, and the surviving two were entered at Le Mans, but retired after mechanical trouble. The winner at Le Mans that year was a radically different factory-sponsored Ford GT40 Mark IV, driven by Dan Gurney and A.J. Foyt. The Mark IV had a new honeycomb chassis and very different coachwork following some changes in Appendix J of the FIA rulebook that allowed for the evolution of existing types that had already been sanctioned for racing. So you've heard the term evoluzione. Well, this is where it comes from. And just a side note here, ironically, it was Enzo Ferrari himself that was responsible for these rule changes, because he'd put pressure on the FIA governing board several years earlier to approve all new bodies on his own cars so that they could be more competitive. And that gave birth to the Ferrari 250 GTO, as well as the Shelby Cobra Daytona Coupe designed by Pete Brock. Anyway, the GT40 Mark IV was wickedly fast down the Mulsanne Straight, 224 miles per hour. But in an effort to lower top speeds in the interest of safety,
The day after the 1967 Le Mans race, the FIA made a rule change restricting engine displacement in the sports car class. The new limit was 3 liters, and that meant the big 427 cubic inch side oiler engine that had been so successful in the GT40s was now banned. But Wire's relationship with Gulf was cemented. They were back at Le Mans in 68.
And this time, Ford was out as a factory team. And so was Ferrari as a protest against the ban on large displacement, but the JW Gulf car ran a 302 V8 in the hands of Pedro Rodriguez and Lucien Bianchi. And they won, with the second and third place Porsches far behind. JW did it again in June 1969, with drivers Jackie Oliver and Jackie Ix battling a Porsche 908 factory entry, and winning by the slimmest margin in the race's history, only 120 meters. It was the fourth and final Le Mans victory for the aging GT40. But for John Wire, bigger things were just around the corner. Oliver and Ix had won the Sebring 12 3 months earlier, and John Wire had earned Porsche's attention and their respect for his ability to take a tiny budget and squeeze so much out of what was basically an obsolete design. Before the race, Wire was offered the helm of a Porsche factory program for the next season. It would be in the 917, a car with a complex history and about which many books have been written. At least 11 different variants were built. And there's no way we're going to cover the whole history of this car, I wouldn't even try, but here's a brief sketch. It had a 4.5-liter air-cooled twin-spark flat 12, and an extremely light tubular space frame weighing just 93 pounds, and portions of the tube frame were actually used in the oiling system. However, Porsche was struggling with one thing, high-speed instability. Wire knew the car was very powerful, and given further development, it could probably eclipse everything else in the prototype class. So he consulted Gulf Oil about Porsche's offer. And by August, it was a done deal. With British management and American sponsorship, Porsche entered the 1970 race season with the goal of winning Le Mans. But they were also supporting another team, Porsche Salzburg, in their 917s. As for the JW Gulf team, testing began immediately, and the greatest concern was the handling. Wire's chief engineer, John Horseman, noticed the long tail section of the car wasn't spattered with insects like the front end, and he concluded that the airflow was disturbed so that the tail wasn't providing the necessary downforce. So a shortened, temporary tail section was hastily fabricated, and the handling improved right away. And that's how they created the 917K, or Kurzheck, meaning short tail. The JW team's four drivers were Pedro Rodriguez of Mexico, Leo Kinnunen of Finland, Joe Siffert, Switzerland, and Englishman Brian Redman. Daytona was this season opener. Ferrari had returned, but the Gulf team came out swinging. And even having to change a clutch in one of the cars during the race, they decisively finished first and second. They faltered a little bit at Sebring when some redesigned front hubs failed, but it was a temporary setback. Brands Hatch in England was next, with Pedro Rodriguez driving like a demon in the rain. In fact, he even said he was driving in the rain as if it were dry pavement. There was a crash on the first lap, and the course was under a yellow flag, but Rodriguez didn't see it through the sheets of relentless rain. So he kept driving as if he were under a green flag, and passed a number of cars. He was black flagged going into the pits, and as a result, he dropped from second place to 12th. Undeterred, for the rest of the race, he hammered his way through the field and came back to win. It was a virtuoso performance of the first order. Then Rodriguez won again at Monza in a pitched battle with the Ferraris. After that, it was the Targa Florio, a 44-mile course on Sicilian roads with over 200 corners. In that particular race, they ran the open-top Porsche 908, which was a smaller car, much more manageable on the windy roads in Sicily. It was Joe Siffert in first place, with Leo Kinnunen coming in second. Next, at Spa, they were number one and two on the grid. At the time, Spa was the fastest circuit in Europe, and the corners were nearly full speed and very hairy.
The Ferrari 512s had gotten faster through the season, and it was an epic battle. Siffert and Redmond managed a win, but Rodriguez and Kinnunen were out with gearbox trouble.
And then came Le Mans, where they fielded three cars. But in John Wire's own words, it was a disaster, with two blown engines and a crash. In the end, it was one of the Salzburg Porsches that took first. But the big subplot of Le Mans in 1970 was Steve McQueen's production of a movie of the same name. It was a passion project he'd been planning for years. And a fourth golf car was supposed to have been driven by McQueen and Jackie Stewart to capture the real race for the film, but it was denied entry. Nevertheless, McQueen's production company shot footage from a 908 it had entered, and the number 20 golf car was a stand-in for his character's car. In the days after the race, they shot more sequences with McQueen driving and a bunch of cameras on the cars. Despite the disappointment of Le Mans, the JW team pressed on, finishing first and second at Watkins Glen, New York, and first at the Österreichring in Austria. With the combined points of the Golf and Salzburg teams, Porsche had secured the 1970 World Championship. In 1971, John Wire's team won 5 of the 11 World Sports Car races, running a slightly larger 4.9-liter flat 12. Yet Le Mans again eluded them, with a blown gearbox in Derek Bell and Joe Siffert's car, and Rodriguez and Oliver out with a burst oil pipe. A Martini Racing 917 was the overall winner. Tragedy didn't escape the alumni of the JW Golf Porsche team. In July 1971, Pedro Rodriguez was killed when his Ferrari 512M lost a tire and hit the wall at the Nürburgring in Germany. He was only 31. And just months later, in the final race of the Formula One season at Brands Hatch, the suspension of Joe Siffert's BRM failed, and it was flung to the outside of a curve, bursting into flames, and he was unable to escape the inferno. He was just 35 years old. Rodriguez and Siffert were both masters of their craft, but it was an era of extreme danger, and they were gone far too soon. Despite not having much of a plot and quite a bit of turmoil during production, McQueen's film of Le Mans was released and has since become a classic. In fact, today it's really seen as more of a documentary than anything. And the backstory is more interesting than the plot anyway. In 1972, the FIA rules changed once again, and the prototype class was now restricted to that 3-liter limit, so the 917 was now banned. Now, parallel to this, there's a whole other story about Golf sponsoring McLaren, but the postscript to the glory years of the blue and orange is that at Le Mans in 1975, with the gas crisis hanging like a vulture over the automotive world, fuel economy rules were put in place, and the race didn't count for the championship. But John Wire saw an opportunity to run a redesigned version of his Mirage chassis again. So they tweaked the fuel economy to squeeze the most out of the car, which was just over 7 miles a gallon, and Golf formulated a special fuel. Derek Bell and Jackie Ickx drove the Mirage to victory. But the glory years for Golf will always be 1968 to 1971. Obviously, the cars were incredible, and their values have skyrocketed, and the mystique of Steve McQueen, the king of cool, has rubbed off big time. And if you've never seen one of those GT40s or 917s up close, don't miss that opportunity if it comes, because they are really incredible in real life.
That's all for this episode of Horsepower Heritage. If you like what you've heard, go to buymeacoffee.com/HP Heritage and drop a few bucks in the gas tank. Tell your friends about the show and leave me 5 stars and a quick review on Apple Podcasts. I'll see you back here on Wednesday, May 8th, for more of the people and stories behind the machines. So until then, I'm Maurice Merrick. Thanks for listening.